It's Thursday, 18th of December 2014. This is HPR episode 1664 entitled Life and Times of a Geek Part 1, and is part of the series How I Found Linux. It is hosted by Dave Morris's and is about 27 minutes long. Feedback can be sent to dave.morrises@gmail.com or by leaving a comment on this episode. The summary is, I've been using computers for more than 40 years. This is part one of my story.
This episode of HBR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HBR15. That's HBR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello, welcome to Hacker Public Radio. My name is Dave Morris. Today I want to do a show for you entitled Life and Times of a Geek. I really liked David Whitman's idea of doing a show on his birthday, if you look at HPR 1547. So I liked it so much I'm borrowing the idea. This show is being released on my 65th birthday, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to tell you about my long experience with computers, or more generically, computational devices, and I've made this part of the series How I Found Linux. Now, thinking about my 65 years, I realised that it might be quite a long show, so I'm going to do a series of short episodes, hopefully not too many. I don't want to bore you too much. I have wanted to do this for a while, and up until now I was concerned. Seems a bit self-indulgent, to be honest, and it doesn't really fit with my way of doing things. But people have said to me, well, just do it. I mean, people can always switch off if they don't like it. Anyway, I hope you do find the shows interesting. So I'll do a little bit of preamble. I was born in the UK in a town called Uxbridge in 1949. The area that Uxbridge is in is now part of Greater London, and it's not very far from Heathrow Airport. When I was a kid, the air in this part of the world was very heavily polluted. Everybody had coal fires. Gas, domestic gas for gas cookers and things, was created by processing coal. So this produced massive amounts of pollution. And I was there during the Great London Smog of 1952, which caused quite a number of fatalities. I guess we escaped a bit, being a bit out of the centre. But there were other smogs thereafter. I remember walking home from school, as you did when you were about 5 years old in those days, and hardly being able to find my way across the street. Because of this pollution, my family decided to move away from the area in 1955. We went to East Anglia, on the east of England, to the city of Norwich, the county of Norfolk. There, it's a bit more agricultural, and the air was a good bit cleaner. I quite enjoyed school when I was young, but I didn't take to secondary school after the age of 11. This was the era of the so-called tripartite system of education, where children were streamed into different types of school according to a test at age 11. I passed this and got a place at a local grammar school, but it was quite strict. You had to wear uniform. They had lots and lots of rules. I really didn't get on with it. Never been that good at people telling me what to do. And it took me quite a long time to get the exams that I needed. Of course, there were no real encounters with computational devices of any sort in those days. Schools at that level didn't have anything like that. If you needed to do anything complicated in the way of arithmetic, then you used log tables, logarithms, and you were all expected to own a slide rule. I've given you some links if you don't know what a slide rule is. There's a picture of my old one looking very battered on the in the show notes. I was a bit of a geek as a child, enjoyed making things, taking stuff apart to see how it worked. I was always fascinated with science and enjoyed biology. I was always a bit of a biology geek and was always watching animals or collecting them, or had an ant's nest in my bedroom, I seem to recall. Had plants and fungi and anything biological, sometimes to my parents' annoyance and disgust, of course. So I left school in 1967 and went to a technical college to take A-levels, which are the advanced exams you need to get into university. This was a much better environment than being at school because it wasn't hidebound with rules and uniform and stuff. It was a bit like being at university. It was a great environment. I studied botany, chemistry and zoology during that time. And it was only at the point I was doing this that it suddenly dawned on me that I could actually go to university and study biology. So I did what was necessary to make that happen. I, quite surprising to me anyway, I got marks good enough to get into university. And I chose the University of Aberystwyth in Mid Wales, where I was going to study zoology. I liked the look of Aberystwyth out in the country by the sea, and just struck me as a good place to be. So I headed off to Aberystwyth in late 1969. It was then called University College of Wales Aberystwyth, and it was part of the larger Federal University of Wales. It's not anymore. It's an independent place. While at school, I'd been pretty bad at mathematics, so I was imagining that I was going down a track where maths was not on the horizon very much at all, which was amazingly naive of me. And it was a bit of a shock to find that we were being taught statistics as part of our biology course. So here's when computation started to come into my life. We had lab sessions where we tediously worked our way through statistical calculations like chi-square test and student's t-test. But the thing that made this so laborious was that we had to use mechanical calculators. We started with hand-cranked calculators, similar to the thing called a triumphator. Never heard of this until I was writing these notes. I couldn't find a picture of the one that we had. But if you look on the Wikipedia link, it's a strange device with a handle on the side that you crank, which you put numbers in on the front by moving different sliders to make a multi-digit number. The multiplication is produced by turning the handle and producing successive additions. I really don't remember how it worked now. It's a long time ago, and I certainly can't remember how we used it for divisions, but we did. Later on, they handed us electromechanical calculators, which is essentially the same thing, except that the handle turning was done by an electric motor, and the numbers were put in on a sort of primitive keyboard type thing. But neither of these were very good, and of course, doing statistics, the actual process of crunching the numbers, was pretty damn tedious using that method. So it's my recollection that about year two, 1970, we were taught the concept of computers and programming. It was quite a short series of lectures. I think students in biological sciences get far more these days. And we had a book which taught us the rudiments of the popular high-level language at the time called Algol 60. Just as an aside, this book was a so-called program text where you read a piece of information, thought about it, and then answered a question. And then, depending on what answer you gave, multiple choice question, you either got positive feedback, yes, this is right, or negative feedback, and sent either forward or backwards through the book to move on to the next thing, or go back to relearn what you'd failed to understand. I find this quite a nice way of learning, actually. I enjoyed this. But it doesn't seem to be very popular. It died out, as far as I'm aware, anyway. Anyway, I found that programming computers was a fascinating idea, even exciting, I think I'd say. It was, I guess this was around the time that I was possibly starting to get more interested in working with computers than being a biologist. So in this course, we had access to the university computer, which was an Elliott 4130. I later discovered that the Elliott company was a pioneer, in at least in Europe, in producing a commercial Algol 60 compiler. I didn't know much about them or who they were or anything special about them at the time. And I must admit, I've not done a huge lot of research until I started putting together this this talk. I've given a few links on the subject in the show notes. There's a lot to research there. I doubt whether anybody would be interested enough to do so, but it's an interesting subject, how computers are developing in the UK at this time. At the point that I was learning this stuff, I was surprised that there weren't many books available on the subject. You couldn't go to the library and find much. I did come by a book called A Course on Programming in Algol 60 later. I don't think you had it at this time. I think I got it later after I'd left Aberystwyth. But I've presented it to you as a photograph of the cover and an example of what's inside. This is similar to the sort of stuff that I was looking at the time. There was a formal language definition called the Revised Report on the Algorithmic Language, Algol 68. Now this is, you can see it yourself in the links, it's pretty heavy going. It's not the sort of thing you'd sit down and read, especially if you're not had much background in this type of stuff, as I didn't. It contains a method of defining computer language using so-called Backus-Naur form, which I actually found was quite an appealing thing once I got my head around it. So I guess I was turning into a computer geek at that point. My hidden geek was revealing itself. So although the whole process of writing programs was utterly fascinating, I found that Algol 60 itself was an odd language. The thing that really got to me was that the language was defined in an odd way. And looking back at it from now, I can see how weird it was. If you look at the example in the book, you'll see that the keywords in the language, like begin and if and then, were marked in bold font. They're not in the sort of font you'd normally see in a computer book. They're in standard font, but they've been made bold. And in the report, which was written in a different way, they were underlined. So, as somebody with a very literal mind, I could not work out how on earth we were supposed to type this stuff in. How were we supposed to do bold stuff on a punched card, which is the way we were preparing stuff? And how were we supposed to underline it? That really puzzled me. Obviously, we were given some sort of answer to this, but it still seemed weird that it was being represented in this way. I think my memory's a bit hazy here, that Elliott Algol used the method of enclosing keywords in single quotes, a method called stropping, interestingly enough. I've given a link to this. I don't have anything in my records about this. It's probably somewhere lurking in the house, but I haven't come across it. I'm in the process of tidying up this house, which is full of junk, but I couldn't find any of this stuff. So certainly other versions of Algol represented the keywords in this way. The other thing I had difficulty with was the way in which symbols like greater than or equal to or the division sign is shown in the texts. A division, integer division, was represented by the thing you'd normally expect to see in a textbook, horizontal line with a dot above and below it. But there is no such symbol. There was no such symbol on the card punches. So there was no way you could actually represent that. So how were you supposed to do it? It seemed, the explanations to how this was to be done seemed very strange to me at the time. The language would be defined in a way that you couldn't actually use. There must have been something that described this. I think there were different ways of dealing with this for the different implementations of Algol. Elliott Algol did it in its own particular way, but I don't recall ever being shown any documentation about it. Of course, it was hard to get hold of stuff like that in those days if it wasn't in the department library. Anyway, not going on about this too much. Algol 60 was quite an advanced language for its time, and it was the precursor to many of the high-level language concepts that you would see later in languages such as C, Modular 2, Pascal, and so on and so forth. It's pretty much the grandfather of a lot of these things. It uses begin and end to enclose blocks of statement, which you can also contain declarations of variable. And each block has its own scope. It invented this idea of scope so that the variables in it were private to the blocks above it, but not within it. And they were destroyed when you exited the block. So this also was found in later languages. Or maybe less so. I think Algol 60 tended to do this more than some of the later languages. Anyway, I thought I'd tell you something a bit about the university computer. This was, as I said, the Elliott 4130, which was, for its time, quite an advanced mainframe. It was to be found in the mathematics department, I think, in on the upper floor. And it was in an inner sanctum, the sort of classic thing where special people were allowed in there and they wore white coats and that type of thing. Us mere humans coming along to use it weren't allowed anywhere near it. It's a 24-bit computer, which seems odd by today's standards. I don't remember how big it was in terms of memory, but the range could go from 32K to 128K. And this was core memory. This was ferrite cores. There's a link to what that is if you're not sure. In 1965, apparently, there had been a government a report written which had recommended computers for UK universities, and they'd said that the Elliott range of machines were to be made available, funded, I guess, because university computing was funded centrally, and Aberystwyth was allocated this particular one. I'm not sure when it arrived, but I think it was a fair bit before I encountered it. So the way of interacting with a computer was to prepare a program, think about what you want to do, design it on a bit of paper, then write it out on a coding sheet. And you'll see what that is in one of the links that talks about the punch card era. Then you'd submit it to data preparation staff who would type it up into punch cards, 80-column cards. It's a picture of, I have a collection of these things in my house. It's a picture of some of them. They'd be returned to you as a card deck between two bits of cardboard to protect them, the rubber band around them. You could have your program punched onto paper tape, but you wouldn't want to do that at this stage, because if you needed to change anything, you had to punch the whole thing again. It was a recommended way of archiving stuff you'd already produced and finished off. It's a picture of a paper tape that I found when I was digging around upstairs recently. I think the deck that you prepared had to have a so-called job control card. This is early command line business, at the front and the back, and this was to say whose job it was and so forth, so that the operators could identify and the computer could also identify. Of course, a whole bunch of card decks would be stacked together and put into the hopper of a card reader and then zipped through it, read by the computer and processed. So the program would run and usually produce line printed output. Oh, it didn't have to, it was the convention. Then the red card deck would be returned along with the printout, which you'd collect. And of course, none of this would happen while you were waiting. You'd submit it, you put it in a pigeonhole, somebody would come and pick it up later on, put it through the computer, return it to the same pigeonhole for you to pick up. So you'd drop the stuff off, wander off, do something else, come back later on. In those days, the mainframe would be unavailable from time to time for various reasons, most of which we didn't fully understand as mere users. And the convention they used was they had a coloured rectangle in a window of the building, an external window, and so you could see from different points around in the campus what colour rectangle was there. If it was green, the mainframe was running, but if it was red, it meant it wasn't. We learnt then to say the computer was down. I don't know why we did that. Down? Why down? I don't know. I do remember somebody actually causing the Elliott to conk out. There was a guy ahead of me waiting to pick something up, He was being scolded by one of the staff of the computer unit because he'd run something. I think he was a computer science student, and I think that you effectively had sole access to this machine with just a very, very thin operating system around your job. And his was an assembly language program which had gone rampaging about all over the place and completely wrecked the operating system and just so crashed it totally, which meant that they then had to go and reload it, which, as I understood at the time and read a bit about afterwards, was not a trivial thing. Getting the machine back to a state where it would run card decks through it was a thing that would take 20 minutes back. But I've not found a huge lot about this. I'm not sure anybody would be that interested if I did, but just as a point of interest. So if your program had errors in it, then you'd need to correct them. I mean, the classic thing would be you'd submit this, you'd get your printout back, and it would say syntax error. You'd forgotten a semicolon or something. So you'd need to correct that. Well, I don't think at that point we were given access to card punches ourselves. So the thing to do was either write out another piece of program on a coding sheet and hand that in to be punched up and then insert it into the deck. Or Aberystwyth had this method. Never saw anybody else do this. They must have had their own customized punch cards produced. They had a red stripe on the bottom edge, and they had an 80-column form, one line of a coding form, actually printed on the front of the card. If you took the card out and wrote your correction on it, and then flipped it upside down so that the red edge showed, and then put it back into the deck, then the operator spotted this on the way in and would repunch that card and replace it. So that was the way in which you edited your program in those. There was some sort of multi-user mode on this machine, I vaguely recall. There was a room with about half a dozen teletypes in it, which could be used for some form of access, simultaneous access to the machine. I think it was only available to the computer science students because I never got access to it. That would have been quite interesting, but it wasn't for the likes of us those days. But it must have been extremely basic stuff. I wonder if anybody listening has any other experience of this. It would be interesting to hear if they have any knowledge of the Elliott 4130 or the Elliott range in general. So what happened then with my dislike of statistics using mechanical calculator? Then, and I think this is what we were expected to do, although not many people did, we would write programs to handle quite a lot of the stuff that we were doing. I don't think there were many people who, after the course, carried on using Algol and programming to do anything very much. But of course, I was getting really excited about this stuff and enjoying it immensely, and was writing programs to do all the various statistical evaluations that we were being required to do. And so I built generic card decks, you know, one for chi-squared, one for t-test, and so on, and all you needed to do was to get the data punched up on cards and stick them on the end of it and then submit it, and there you get back an answer to your calculation without having to do any nasty hand cranking and or whatever other method of calculating this stuff. So this came to the attention of the staff in the department, I was asked if I would be prepared to donate these programs to the department. And I think there was some sort of an online library system, probably on Magtape or something, that the department was maintaining. So I did this, and obviously I had to do documentation with it. I was asked to do this, so I remember writing this stuff out. Here's how you did it, and you know what you had to put in, because it was all data in specific columns and this type of stuff. How you signaled to the program that was the end of the data, which was not a trivial matter in those days, strangely. So the documentation was then handed in, typed up by one of the departmental typists, and put in the annals of the department. So I guess I can finish by saying that somewhere in the early 1970s, I was contributing to a type of open source software, not at a world level, but at least the level of the zoology department of Aberystwyth University. Hope you enjoyed that. That's the end of my first summary of my geeky life. Okay, bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.